The microbiome may also hold the secret to a phenomenon which is causing serious long-term damage to the health and well-being of people in developing and emerging nations. In the transition from poor to less poor, the people of such nations put on significant excess fat in their abdomens and can have extraordinary rates of type 2 diabetes and heart disease, and it's been really hard to tackle. A study published last week from the University of Sydney may go some of the way to explain this side effect of economic development. Anand Hardikar was one of the lead researchers involved.
What we knew in humans is that if you look worldwide, there's majority, I mean, 4 out of 5 type 2 diabetic individuals in the world are from the developing countries. And that's something that we...
So that's not just about numbers. That's something that coming from a developing country confers something special.
Some high risk, yeah. And what we knew from human studies is that although lifestyle changes are worldwide, and you can see lifestyle changes happening everywhere, from less physical activity in terms of high calorie rich diets and all those kind of things, the major factor which drove was that if you were from a specific ethnic background or from one of the developing countries, then you would basically be at more risk of type 2 diabetes, obesity and cardiovascular diseases.
So this is the story that in Australia, if your ethnicity originates in the Indian subcontinent, you are at risk of type 2 diabetes at a lower BMI than somebody who's Anglo.
Absolutely.
And similarly from Southeast Asia or Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander.
One of the major reasons for this study came from trying to understand what is different with the individuals in the developing countries, that there's 70% of type 2 diabetes burden is going to lie in the developing countries. What's different with them? And we knew that overall, if you look at their genomes, they are fairly similar.
So there's nothing obvious in their genes.
Yeah, in terms of the gene sequences, there's not many SNPs or other things that can be very well linked with the Indian specifically, but it's more of the what we call as the epigenetics of type 2 diabetes.
It can be hard to get your head around epigenetics, but it's turning out to be critically important to the way that the environment in which we live, the food we eat, the exercise we take, the toxins we're exposed to, can affect how our genes work. Epigenetic changes do not involve mutations in the genetic code. Our DNA remains the same. Epigenetics are chemical changes which occur around the outside of our genes, changing the way they operate, a bit like the volume switch on your radio. And as I said, these effects on our genes are exquisitely influenced by our environment. Anand Hardikar again.
These are because they depend on what you eat, the kind of lifestyles. They depend on a number of factors, including our recent studies, which are emerging out of this research published today, are on the gut microbiota, which tell us how the microbes in the gut can influence our genes as well. So that's where we are leading to, but it all is linked to epigenetic modifications.
So your hypothesis was that you might have a problem dating back to poor nutrition in developing countries, which might have created an epigenetic effect. In other words, changed the shape of the genes and therefore their function.
Actually, to be very, very frank, it was a serendipitous observation. And we observed a colony of rats that was several-fold higher risk of type 2 diabetes and they were a bit obese. And we started understanding their diets and we identified that they have been undernourished for at least 10 years. And this was because of the funding situation and the feed was optimized by the animal care provider to suit the budget.
So that's like 5 generations of rats.
No. That's close to around 40 generations of rats. So,
really?
So the gestational period is around 21 days in rats. So in 21 days, you have pups which are born who will become mature by around 8 weeks of age. So you can have 3 to 4 generations in a year. So roughly in 10 years, you have 40 generations.
So by accident, you had an experimental model.
Absolutely. What we identified was that these animals had higher risk of developing diabetes. If you give them a toxin that would make them diabetic in normal rats, you'll have to use 8 times less doses to make these animals diabetic. And we identified that it was mainly the food. So we decided to systematically reproduce this model. And what we were able to find was in 12 years, we had these undernourished rats, and they were marginally overweight. A normal rat would have around, say, 12% body fat. These undernourished rats, for 50 generations of undernutrition, were almost like 18% body fat. So we decided to do what most of the doctors would do is put someone who is undernourished on a normal diet. And what we found was that instead of having them cured, we saw that they were storing all of the excess calories as fat, and they were showing 25% body fat. That increase in adiposity was something that we didn't expect at all.
Which is just what happens in what's called epidemiological transition, which is when developing countries go from poor to middle income.
Absolutely.
You get this incredible increase in weight, which happened in Australia just after World War II, and is happening as we speak in India and many developing and many middle income countries.
China, many countries. So overall, what we had replicated in this model was a high carb, a low protein, calorically restricted in the undernourished animals for 50 generations. So I think that basically provides us a very good model to understand what's going on in human populations, possibly.
Do you think that what's happened with these rats is there was a change right at the beginning and that's just been perpetuated in these multi-generations of their descendants, or there have been multiple changes with each generation?
I think it's an additive phenomenon. That we really, unfortunately, we do not have all the samples that we would need to really dissect it at every level. But I think what is interesting is that, yeah, we don't have all the time points, but I think what we do know from some of them is that these changes get added on in successive generations and they're all heritable by epigenetics.
So what's the conclusion? The conclusion, I mean, I understand from the conclusion is these are normal rats to start with. They go through these multi-generations of undernutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're arguing then is that undernutrition changes the shape of their genes permanently.
Yeah, so epigenetic changes by definition are heritable. So once the changes are introduced in generations following nutrient insults or something, I mean, they will be retained in their genes for several generations. And what was really intriguing was that when we put them on a normal diet, these changes that were already inherited for several generations were not totally reversed. They were improved, but they were not reversed back to normal control levels, which is interesting.
Do you have any evidence yet about if this hypothesis is true, how many generations it takes to wash out, if indeed it ever washes out?
Well, these are studies which are in progress. What we thought was important to report first was that these changes don't reverse simply by putting them on a normal diet, because those...
Or migrating to Australia.
it's basically that these changes need to be supplemented, probably. I mean,
If this applies to humans, is a good question.
Yeah, if this applies to humans, yeah. So there's a lot of fine print here. Multiple studies that we're carrying out in rats, we do think that there's major links to vitamin B12 levels, which are very low in most of the individuals from the Indian subcontinent, especially. And what we do see is that high levels of folate, lower levels of B12, which is typically seen in Asian Indians, is also replicated in this animal model. So there's a trial that we want to conduct with an intervention with B12 supplementation along with nutrient transition, which it's something that is one of the factors that we're testing amongst multiple. But what we believe is the major source for B12 is bacteria in the gut. And the bacteria in the gut, or the gut microbiota, there are 10 times more bacteria in our guts than the number of cells in our body. So they have a really large impact on our bodies. And these bacteria are also the source of vitamin B12. There's a lot of interplay.
And what's the link between vitamin B12 and this epigenetic change due to malnutrition causing obesity and type 2 diabetes?
Well, I wish I had a straightforward answer to that. We really don't know if vitamin B12 drives the epigenetic changes. But lower levels of vitamin B12 and higher homocysteine and folate is what has been shown in clinical studies in the Asian Indians. So what we think is we have a model that reproduces several aspects of those kind of markers seen in human studies. So I think what this gives us is an opportunity to look at the molecular level to try and understand what changes happen to the epigenome following specific intervention. May these be probiotics, or maybe these be some kind of manipulations with the bugs, or may it be dietary supplementations with B12 or folic acid or vitamin D or something else.
And it reinforces the idea that if you've got a mother who's disadvantaged and malnourished, it is possible that she is passing on these epigenetic changes to her offspring, which may perpetuate.
Yeah, malnutrition is a bit different than undernutrition, I'll say, but there is evidence from many other studies. I mean, I think it was a cohort from Nippon to Honolulu to San Francisco.
There's the Honolulu Heart Study.
I mean, there are many other examples where we know that any kind of maternal deprivation of nutrients in the first three or last 3 months of pregnancy can lead to metabolic alterations in the progeny. What is important is if there's history of undernutrition for longer periods, then it can be really more disadvantageous advantageous to the progeny than if it was not the case.
Anand Hardikar is an associate professor and NHNMRC future fellow at the NHNMRC Clinical Trials Centre at the University of Sydney. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been the Health Report.